I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Dan Coe, and you remember him. He and Max Blumenthal made that great documentary, Killing Gaza. Have I mentioned I want you to look at that? Uh-huh. Killing Gaza. Costs a few bucks on Vimeo. $3 or something to watch it. It's incredible, okay? Please do. And then also, he works for RT. He's a correspondent for RT, and he works with Max Blumenthal over there at the Gray Zone Project. The Gray Zone, that's a reference by the Al-Qaeda, ISIS-type enemies to freedom and tolerance and mutual respect by people who get along rather than picking sides and determining to fight in a war of us against them forever. So what a great name for a thing, too, by the way. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Dan?
I'm good. Good to be with you, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you here. And so, wow, what a great job you did on this. It's a video presentation, so you can share with all your Facebook friends and everything. Guys, it's called Presenting the Syria Deception. Al-Qaeda Goes to Hollywood. And it's a great walk down memory lane to what's now, you know, ancient history, 2011. And it really, we could go back before that, but I don't know. Anyway, in this case, you talk about since the Arab Spring and the hijacking by America and Saudi, well, for that matter, Turkey and Israel and other of our allies in what started as the protest movement against Bashar al-Assad there early on, and the incredible public relations project, the award-winning Academy Award-winning public relations project by America's allied CIA allied Al-Qaeda forces in the Syria war, which is not quite over yet. Never mind Kurdistan and Iran and all that, but just in terms of the war against the jihadists, they still are in Idlib as we record this. But what a great recap of the almost unbelievable. It is the unbelievable, the completely false reality that these people created in this Syrian war. So first of all, congratulations on this great piece of work. Hope everyone will go and look at it. And secondly, to the point, you did a real good job of showing what's really what here. And are you ever surprised by that? I guess that's my first question for you. Do you ever find yourself going, man, I can't believe they got away with this to the degree that they did?
Oh, totally. I'm still in shock. I mean, when we came up with the name Al-Qaeda Goes to Hollywood, it's like, it sounds like too absurd to be real, but it's totally what it is. I mean, it is, you know, if we think about what Al-Qaeda is in the American mind, and especially, you know, 15, 16, 17 years ago after 9/11, I mean, to think that 15 years later, we are basically, you know, you could say indirectly supporting or protecting Al-Qaeda in Syria as the Syrian government and its allies try to quash the last remnants, the last stronghold, and liberate its territory. You know, if you told me that 15 years ago, I would have said you're crazy. But it's, unfortunately, it's the reality of what's happening over there. And so what I kind of set out to do is show through this documentary, I set out to show how Al-Qaeda has been totally rehabilitated in the American mind through a very broad and deep propaganda campaign that kind of covers all of you know, mass media that we're subjected to, whether it's kind of, you know, daily news reports on CNN or you know, and it's from like liberal to conservative in our mainstream media. It's like Fox, CNN, MSNBC, kind of whatever your slant is. And then also through Hollywood. And so basically my film picks apart this movie called Cries from Syria, which came out, I think in 2016. And basically I show the individual psyops, the, you know, psychological operations, as the CIA would call them. And I go through the different characters, and, you know, this guy is portrayed as a hero. You know, for instance, Hadi Abdullah is one of the, like, big heroes. He's, like, the journalist hero who's, like, braving Assad's bombs to show us the truth of what's really happening. And then you look around a little bit online, and it turns out, oh, this guy's just embedded with Al-Qaeda and Jund al-Aqsa and, you know, all these, like, kind of different fanatic groups that are, you know, basically Al-Qaeda or off-brand of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And, you know, basically that's the theme throughout the movie, throughout the documentary, is that all of these characters, it turns out, are jihadis or are being, you know, there's the 7-year-old girl, Bana al-Abed, who is not a jihadi herself. She's a little girl. But she's exploited in this movie to basically say, not only in this movie, on Twitter, throughout mass media. She was on CNN. She was interviewed and exploited by her parents and her handlers in order to basically stimulate, you know, tug at Western heartstrings for intervention in Syria, that, like, our bombs are going to actually help people. And it's just the most cynical propaganda. And it's, you know, to me, it takes advantage of media consumers, because frankly, most people don't have time to sit there and, you know, pick apart this crazy propaganda and spend their time going through YouTube videos and reading this and that and the next thing. I mean, people have jobs and they have kids and they have families. And so it's like, you know, they come home from work, turn on the TV for 20 minutes, see something horrible in Syria, and they're like, well, you know, at least we can do something good there. We can save that little girl. Yeah, let's drop those bombs. So, you know, I just wanted to kind of push back against that pro-regime change, imperialist, militaristic narrative.
Yeah. Well, and so that's the thing too, right, is, the gap, right, between the narrative and the reality here. And the most outrageous thing about it is it's really been known all along by those who were critical. I need to hunt down this footnote now that I think about it, but I'm certain it was in The Observer, which is like the weekend edition of The Guardian over there, where a very well-connected and informed writer was talking about how Prince Bandar is sending young jihadist fighters off to Syria to go fight. Well, I mean, just rewind even to earlier that year. In fact, we still had troops in Iraq fighting on the Shia side against the last smallest remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in other words, the Islamic State of Iraq, still fighting them in 2011. They didn't leave until the end of 2011. So at the same time that was the policy, and they still were using drones and still, you know, remained a bit after that, fighting against these exact same Sunni jihadists, the enemy from Iraq War II, never mind 9/11, but from more recent than that, from Iraq War II. And there they are from the very beginning. Yep, they're sending foreign jihadists to go in there to fight. The guys who would have been Zarqawi's guys if he were still alive. And then it was the U.S. State Department that, and this is so important too, the State Department told McClatchy newspapers, and I don't know if it was at a briefing or exactly how it came out, but it came out very early on in 2011 that there are a bunch of guys from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, from Iraq, who are now coming into Syria to pick up this fight and take on this thing. And then, of course, Phil Giraldi published a thing at antiwar.com and at the American Conservative in December of 2011 saying that Obama signed a new finding authorizing, two new findings, I guess, authorizing stepped up covert action in Syria and Iran. Oh, and I left out Eric Margulies in the summer, I think in August of 2011, came back from France and said, yeah, the French were over there on the ground, special operations forces helping plan the war with these, you know, rebels on the ground etc. like that. And it's also been known all along that the so-called moderates were a bunch of freaks and kooks. And, you know, the Northern Storm Brigade admitted to Time Magazine before John McCain went and made friends with them that they were veterans of Iraq War II. They were part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq fighting against the Americans. And those were the guys he went and met with on the porch. And they ended up, they were the ones who captured Stephen Sotloff and sold him to Al-Qaeda, who cut his head off. And then you had the Farouk Brigade, who said, oh, yeah, we want to hold elections. Give us some money and some guns. But their commander was the guy on camera eating a guy's heart, a dead soldier's heart. So, yeah, other than that, they're really moderate, besides the cannibalism. And then you have this Al-Ziki Brigade, who, yeah, they're very moderate. Here's some money. Here's some guns and some tow missiles and whatever else. And they're the ones who, like, boastfully on camera filming themselves cut the head off of a 12-year-old boy, a Palestinian boy from a refugee camp. And so I just, the very worst, there was even in 2000, I think it was early 2012, there was a young boy who made a joke at his little vegetable stand. A guy wanted a discount, and he said, hey, I wouldn't even give a discount to Mohammed. And an Al-Qaeda guy shot him right in the face and killed him. And he was like a 14-year-old boy, just kind of making a crack. And that was the heart of the rebellion from the very beginning. Even David Sanger, of all people, in the New York Times said, geez, well, since moderates don't do much fighting and extremists do, guess who's getting all the guns and the money and using them? The extremists. But who are the extremists? Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria. From the very get-go, we knew this all along. Anybody could check my archives. It's all there. I don't know exactly when you caught on to this stuff. I know Blumenthal was late, but is really good on it now. But all this has been known from the very, very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, if for, you know, those of us who did pay attention, exactly, the signs were all there. And, you know, I think really if you know anything about the U.S.'s, the roots of Al-Qaeda, the roots of this kind of these kind of fanatics, then you know that it goes back to the U.S. Basically the intervention, arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in order to fight the Soviet Union. And basically that is what gave birth to Al-Qaeda. And so there's been this kind of love-hate relationship for decades, you know, going back to the 70s and 80s with Al-Qaeda and, you know, Islamist fanatics who, you know, are totally anti-democratic and have this awful version of Islam that they want to impose on the Middle East and, you know, in what they view as their caliphate. And I should say, you know, I think it's important that we distinguish between the Islam that most Muslims practice versus the Wahhabist version that Saudi Arabia, the very close ally of the U.S. And the West, that they export, which is this hardline version where minorities are wiped out, and there's no room for, there's no tolerance or anything, and it's completely antithetical to, you know, our professed Western ideals. And that's actually, you know, the progenitor of ISIS is Saudi Arabia, and it all exists because of our Western imperial relationship with these countries. And so the U.S. has long used, and Britain have long used Al-Qaeda and these kind of fanatical groups as kind of a cudgel against, you know, before it was the Soviet Union, now it's, you know, then it was against Syria and Afghanistan. And so it's, you know, the U.S. has kind of had this off and on relationship. And so I think, I mean, I was 17 when 9/11 happened, and it was so shocking for me. And, you know, I didn't believe in going to war in Afghanistan or Iraq then, but I wasn't really politicized at the point enough to understand what it was really based on, other than a big lie. But you know, the greater context of why did, you know, these fanatics run some airplanes into the Twin Towers? And then, you know, anyone who really knows the real story, though, shouldn't be surprised by that stuff. And I really worry about what the future holds, especially in Europe. I mean, you know, in the U.S., we're a little bit more insulated from it. We're a lot more insulated from it because we have, you know, oceans in between. But a lot of these fanatics They end up going to Europe. Many of them are from Europe. The most hardline ones are from Western countries where, you know, they may have been kind of isolated, and they go and do jihad in order to kind of have some meaning in their life or something. And so, you know, there's the real potential for these guys to go back to their home countries and carry out terrorist attacks. We've seen it time and time again. And basically the Western authorities, whether it's MI6, they, you know, keep tabs on these guys and then kind of watch it happen. And it's just, to me, it's just one of the biggest scandals ever, and really kind of says everything about what our government is doing. I mean, one of the only people, politicians that I've seen talk about, you know, the U.S. basically protecting al-Qaeda in Syria is Tulsi Gabbard. And she's taken a lot of heat for it. But it's unbelievable to me that, you know, all these years after 9/11, that it is considered outlandish or outside the political consensus for a politician to say, hey, we shouldn't be supporting al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just really says everything about kind of the big fishbowl that we're living in, you know, that U.S. media, that Western media has subjected us to, where every, you know, 5 years or 10 years or 10 minutes, we kind of like run into the glass bowl and dink, and then turn around to the next one. And so, you know, it's why it's so important for us to have independent media like yourself, or for foreign media to be allowed in this country. You know, like where I work at RT, where I get to talk about this stuff, because I've been marginalized from, you know, other media outlets. So, you know, I appreciate your work, Scott, a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I don't think there's any question that your work speaks for itself, and it's always very well and professionally done, and leaves nothing to criticize I've seen. So, well, I wouldn't say nothing, but I can't think of anything anyway. So, yeah, it's definitely quality stuff. Otherwise, I wouldn't be recommending it so badly. But and especially Killing Gaza. Everybody watch Killing Gaza. But anyway, so yeah, now you're making such an important point about the next wave of terrorists here. You know, these guys, it's sort of like in skateboarding where a generation goes by in just like 5 or 10 years instead of 20. You know, it's the same kind of thing with these terrorists, where we just keep creating more and more generations and half generations of these guys ever since the war in Afghanistan, as you say. And back then using them to fight the Russians. And then this is the point I'm always trying to hammer home. I don't know, maybe everybody disagrees with me that this is such the important point that I think is just central to everything, which is that Iraq War II inadvertently was not supposed to be this way. It was supposed to empower the Shia. It was not supposed to empower Iran. It was supposed to somehow give America more influence over Iran with the support of the Iraqi Shia base or some kind of nonsense that Chalabi sold Paul Wolfowitz. And then that didn't happen. And so it was the Iranians who won out, and it was America who fought a war for Iran to put the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawah Party in there. And by 2006, somebody finally let Zalmay Khalilzad, original neocon, studied under Strauss and all that, explain to George W. Bush that, look, this is a real severe own goal here. We didn't mean to empower Iran this way, but we kind of have no choice but to finish the job we started here now. But then we need to tilt back toward the Sunnis in every other place in the region, tilt back towards Saudi Arabia and do what they want, which is fine, except the Americans don't want to put American infantry on the ground all over the place anymore. And Saudi doesn't really have a field army. They just have a National Guard for oppressing their own population with. So who does Saudi have as their forces to deploy except al-Qaeda? That's their side. So that's making up to our friend. After all, why did al-Qaeda hate us in the first place? Because we were too close to the king of Saudi. For we were too close of allies for the people of Saudi, or these people of Saudi Arabia's wishes. And but so when that means when we go back to their side after the big blunder in Iraq War II, empowering the Iranians and the Shia, then that means backing al-Qaeda in Syria. And we've known that really since 2007 when Seymour Hersh wrote The Redirection. And I interviewed him about it then, that our new policy is to back al-Qaeda types in Lebanon, Fatah al-Islam, Muslim Brotherhood groups in Syria, and Jandallah in eastern Iran. And so that was going back to then. That was the same policy that Obama picked up and continued, trying to make it up to the Saudis by, as you say, deploying the only forces they have, a bunch of suicide bombers.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, we have to understand this stuff in geopolitical terms and not kind of isolate it, you know, and oversimplify. And, you know, it's the Macron, the you know, of France recently, he just outright said, you know, the reason that we don't want Russia and Syria to attack Al-Qaeda in Idlib, you know, Idlib province in northern Syria is kind of the last stronghold of Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the estimates of how many fighters are there range from like 15,000 to 50,000. And he said, well, we don't want them, you know, we don't want that to happen because then some of these guys will come home. And so, you know, he just said it openly. Like, it's kind of, yeah. I mean, it's almost like Trump where like. Oh, yeah.
And I'm sorry, because I went off on that tangent, didn't follow that thought through, right? About this is now the next generation of dealing with that. So,
no, it's all right.
They were our enemies, and then that ended up becoming our reason for using them again. No, it's totally my fault that I forgot what I was trying to say. But then, yeah, so that's the point. So then this whole time that America and France and Britain have taken the side of the jihadists along with Turkey and Israel and Saudi and Qatar and et cetera this whole time, that this has been the looming threat. That what happens when after these guys lose, because they won't follow through and bomb Assad out of power in Damascus. So, okay, so they let him win after all, leave these guys high and dry, which I predicted years ago, of course, too. So what's going to happen to them? And now, as you're saying, now we have Macron saying, oh, no, what's going to happen to these guys? And so I don't know what his solution is. Leaving them alone is better than letting the Russians finish them off.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. He hasn't offered any kind of solution, of course. And so it's like, I mean, basically the only thing that's prevented this, you know, the liberation on Idlib, which very well could be very bloody, not to, you know, diminish the possibility of civilians
right.
being you know, hurt or killed there. But, you know, well, one point I want to make about that, of all these, what I would say are crocodile tears for the people of Idlib, the civilians there, you know, let's point out that nobody cared at all about the civilians of Idlib until Russia and Syria were about to liberate it.
You mean none of the hawks, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. None of the hawks, the people who are, you know, who are putting out these crocodile tears now, nobody cared about the people living under Al-Qaeda. Nobody cared. None of them cared about the, you know, Druze or Christians who were slaughtered or forced to convert under Al-Qaeda. Nobody said anything about them. It's only until, you know, Al-Qaeda is about to be defeated that suddenly, oh my God, we have to stop this genocide. And it's just, it's absolutely
It's also
absurd.
A rerun of what we already saw previously in Eastern Damascus and in Aleppo before that.
Exactly.
Where
exactly.
This completely paper thin narrative that, so what's going on here is that Assad just wants to murder every last civilian that he can inside his country, and these rebels are trying to stop him. And so then if that was true, right, you would expect then once the rebels are rousted out of there, he would complete the killing of all the people in eastern Aleppo, in eastern Damascus, et cetera. And so what happens in every case is that, oh, good, the jihadists got on a bus and got the hell out of here, the ones that were left. Now the civilian population can come back, and all the fighting stops, and all the fighting follows, guess who? The armed insurrection, armed by the CIA and friends, insurrection that's picked this fight this whole time. Imagine that.
Exactly. I mean, September of this year saw the least killings of since the beginning of the war in Syria. So, you know, that says everything. As the Syrian government and Russia are basically ending the war, people are dying less, refugees are able to come home, much to the chagrin of the Western leaders. And as much as Donald Trump, you know, wants to say, you know, well, the Idlib offensive didn't happen because of my tweets, it was actually because of diplomacy between Russia and Turkey. And as much as, you know, Turkey has kind of straddled the line between staying with the Americans and you know, wanting to collapse the Syrian government and has done everything it can possible, it's also kind of forced to reckon with reality and knows that the Americans also are not trustworthy and has had to side with Russia to a degree. And so that's the only reason we haven't seen it happen. And frankly, I mean, I hope that, you know, these Al-Qaeda fighters will lay down their arms and, you know, they'll be the ones who are Syrian will be dealt with by their government, and the ones who are foreign will be dealt with by their own governments. But, you know, basically the most fanatical ones, the most extreme ones, are the foreign fighters who come from, you know, the UK or the West and say, well, we don't have anywhere to go, and we'll be prosecuted if we go back to our country. So we're just going to continue to fight and, you know, shed as much blood as possible of civilians.
Well, it raises an important question whether they really would be prosecuted. I mean, who knows what's going to happen when they come home?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you never know. We remember the Ariana Grande attack, the attack on the Ariana Grande concert. That was carried out by
this is the Westminster attack.
Yeah, exactly. Where a bunch of little girls at a concert got killed. Well, that was carried out by Mohamed Mwazi, who was fighting with the LIAF, which is basically an al-Qaeda group in Libya.
The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, right. The Libyan veterans of Iraq War II, where they were with Zarqawi, right.
Exactly. And so that's the blowback that we see. And unfortunately, I think we'll continue to see because, you know, our governments just at the end of the day, they're much more interested in keeping these guys around. In order to, you know, use them for their next proxy war instead of protecting, protecting civilians and letting little girls go to concerts in peace without, you know, fear of being attacked by some jihadi fanatic. But, you know, I also think, you know, this is kind of what have we seen? Four regime change wars in the last, in the last 15 years. Or 17 years. I mean, I think
four and a half anyway. Yeah, if you count Syria as half of one.
Yeah,
forget Saleh.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think it's kind of one of the last hurrahs. I mean, the Trump administration, you know, filled with these like neocon uber hawks, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo.
And again, the context is this is all about Iran. As Obama said, I always bring this up, but sorry. But yeah, as Obama said to Jeffrey Goldberg, yes, this is all about taking Iran down a peg by weakening or destroying their only last Arab allied state, the Baathist state of Syria, which is run by the Alawites, who are very close to the Shiites and part of that ruling coalition there and have this alliance with Iran and with Hezbollah for that matter. And so that's what it's all about. And so, yep.
Yeah, and so I think we're kind of seeing the last hurrah here. I mean, it's not pretty on the inside of the United States to see, I'm in D.C. I see so much poverty. There's so much kind of awful stuff going on, and but the U.S. is losing on the international stage and all of its aggression towards Iran. I mean, today the Trump, Pompeo announced that the U.S. is pulling out of major international treaties, is rejecting the International Court of Justice. We recently rejected the International Criminal Court. And so, you know, basically the Trump administration and its desperate attempt to isolate Iran and implement regime change in Iran is losing. It can't get Europe on board. Russia stepped in Syria. Basically, no one wants to do this anymore because they see what the results are, even though, you know, they may not be such humanitarians themselves and actually care for human lives. They realize it's bad for their own interests. I think it's kind of the real decline of the U.S. empire is what we're witnessing under Donald Trump.
Yeah. All right, you guys, here's how to support the show. First of all, subscribe to the RSS feeds, iTunes, Stitcher, and all of that. All the feeds are available at scotthorton.org and also at libertarianinstitute.org. You can also follow me on youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. And sign up for Patreon. If you do, anybody who signs up for $1 per interview gets 2 free books from Listen and Think Audio. And also, you'll get keys to the new Reddit page, reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. And then if you go to scotthorton.org/donate, $20 will get you the audiobook of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. $50 will get you a signed copy of the paperback there. And $100 donation will get you either a QR code, commodity disc, or a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks. That's all at scotthorton.org/donate. And also anybody donating $5 or more per month there. If you already are, or if you sign up now, you'll get keys to that new Reddit group as well. Already got about 50 people in there, and it's turning out pretty good. Again, that's reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. If you're already donating or you're a new donor, just email me scott@scotthorton.org and I'll get you the keys there. And hey, do me a favor, give me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher, or if you liked the book on amazon.com, and the audiobook is also on iTunes, and I sure would appreciate that. And listen, if you want to submit articles to the Libertarian Institute, please do, and they don't have to be about foreign policy. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Well, and you know, I was talking about this a little bit earlier with Gareth about how, yeah, there's really probably not going to be a war with Iran. Was it Gareth? I can't remember. I did so many interviews today, I can't keep them straight. But anyway, there's not going to be a war with Iran because they really need a new big excuse to do so. But at the same time, they are pushing the idea that they can somehow make the Iranian regime fall with economic pressure and quite possibly redirection style support for these jihadi groups against them. I don't know for sure, but this Avaz attack is a sure suspicious example of that, with the whole Iran working group and any of that. So they could, with their policies, really paint themselves into a corner where all of their brilliant plans, where Giuliani said, trust me, if you just push them a little bit, they'll fall over. When that doesn't work, when Bolton's plan of sanctions and support for groups and whatever, when that doesn't pan out, then what? They have to escalate or admit defeat at that point, when they've already committed that much more than where they already are now? So I don't know.
Exactly.
Trump seems to think that, oh, I'm going to get a deal out of them probably pretty soon here. But yeah, I don't know if that really is right. Bolton's plan always is for whatever negotiation to fail so that he can say, see, you can't negotiate with these people. That's his thing on Korea, Iran, forever and always.
Right, exactly. I mean, Bolton is just the uber hawk, and, you know, he doesn't. I mean, I'd like to see him, you know, go head first I'd like to see him get parachuted into Idlib and see how he fares. But
no parachute, just drop him on the place.
Just drop him. Maybe he'll bounce around a few times and get up. But yeah, I mean,
don't worry, you know, they'll catch you, John. Go ahead.
I mean, Trump is totally surrounded by these guys, and I mean, you know, Trump is not an ideological neocon or anything. He's just like a businessman and nationalist. And so, you know, it's interesting because his first instincts are sometimes correct, where he's like, you know, the troll we saw before he was running for president, you know, where he'd tweet, you know, why are we in Iraq? This is a waste of money and our soldiers are dying to, you know, and Obama is supporting Al Qaeda and all this stuff. I mean, that's his real instincts, but he's just totally surrounded by all these fanatics and is kind of, you know, out of his element, doesn't really know foreign policy that well. But he's got Pompeo in his ear. He's got Jared Kushner basically, you know, giving him Israel's guidance, throughout, the political process. And so he's just, I think, you know, he can be convinced. It's, you know, it's like Benjamin Netanyahu said back in, the early 2000s, America is a thing that can be easily moved. And I think that's, you know, truer than ever, with Donald Trump.
He added, you know, it's absurd.
yeah, exactly.
I love that. That's my favorite quote ever of anybody, yeah. I think. It's absurd what they let me get away with, he's saying.
It really is. I mean, just yesterday, the $3.8 billion per year that Obama promised kicked in. And what was really interesting to me about that, the State Department released this statement saying, you know, this is a great example of bipartisanship from the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wait, I thought Trump, you know, we always hear that Trump is so, he hates Obama so much that he's always trying to undo his legacy, destroy his legacy. That was part of the motivation for the Iran deal. But when it comes to, you know, giving Israel all the weapons it can get to, you know, to kill Palestinians in Gaza or to, you know, bomb Syria, then it's totally bipartisan. And so, you know, that's like the real interference in this country is, you know, is Israel, is Saudi Arabia, is the United Arab Emirates. That's the political, you know, interference, the collusion. And so all this talk about Russia, some of it has actually revealed Israeli and Saudi collusion. But it's all kind of a, you know, a very thin veil for you know, the truth about what this country is. The D.C. is, you know, it is a swamp, and it's just infested with lobbyists, you know, legalized bribery. And that's our political system. And it's, you know, it's losing on the international stage. Basically, you know, the U.S. is becoming weaker. And, you know, in my opinion, it's better to see the rise of a multilateral, a multipolar system where the U.S. doesn't have so much say in what goes on in international affairs, and, you know, countries like China and Russia, and, you know, the EU are not totally on board and can kind of stand up and say, hey, no, you know, we're not on board with this.
Well, even it's though, already happening for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Kruthammer is dead and the unipolar moment is over.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah.
Couldn't, and because even, of Kruthammer, right? Because of Kruthammer's war, Krauthammer's war, whatever, in Iraq War II. That was what was the final meaningless waste of America's energy in trying to dominate the planet in the most ridiculous and meaningless mission that they could
That was the golden age. I mean, you know, Russia stood by when the U.S. Bombed Libya. You know, backed the jihadis over there and let the Libyan government collapse. And then they said, wait a minute, we're not going to let this happen. And even, you know, they stayed out of Syria until 2015, until the government was about to collapse. And then they finally stepped in and said, you know what, this is bad for us. You know, another government collapsing. Russia has dealt with jihadis more than the U.S. has. And so they're, you know, much more kind of connected to reality than the administration here in Washington is.
Yeah, well, and so, much more connected geographically is the real point.
Exactly.
Right? Where you have all these Chechens fighting in Syria. Well, what's the opposite of that? Like we were talking about, when these guys come home. And in fact, we already saw, right, that one good, there's been a lot of interference on behalf of Al-Qaeda over at The Intercept there, Murtaza Al-Qaeda, I call him. But there was some good reporting at The Intercept about how some of these jihadists were over helping the Nazis fight against the separatists in the Donbass, so long as they could try to get a chance to kill a Russian.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's what
already
that's what
coming
it's all
back
about.
And blowing back in that way to Russia. So yeah, you could see why they'd be worried about that.
Yeah, exactly. The proxies for the West, you know, it's not only it's not only Wahhabists. There's also the, you know, the fanatics and the neo-Nazi fanatics in Ukraine. And it's kind of the same story with, you know, the dirty wars of the 80s in Central America. So, you know, hopefully those days are coming to an end.
Which, by the way, remember in 2015 when Putin, or I guess Assad, pulled his Trump card in bringing Putin in to save the regime there, as even Kerry admitted was the case and all of that, they started talking about, hey, I know, not that this could ever apply to us, mind you, but hey, guys, it's sort of like the 80s, where we support a bunch of enemies to bog the Russians down and hurt them and bleed them to bankruptcy. And we're warning you, Gates and Obama said, this is going to be a quagmire for you and all that. That was when Gates was on his way out, I think. Had that right. But they were, that's what they were saying. It was like, hey, we could replicate Afghanistan in the 80s. Not that we know anything about replicating the war in Afghanistan in the 80s. And let's try that. And then this was just the recent quote from David Ignatius, who's the CIA spokesman, editorial writer in the Washington Post. I mean, barely unofficial, but I guess I could add that. And Ignatius just was quoting these guys the other day as saying, yeah, no, when it comes to the Idlib province, what we want to do is bog Russia down in a quagmire rather than sit back and shrug and say, okay, game is up and we forfeit our Al-Qaeda jihadists because who needed them anyway, which ought to be easy enough to do.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they wrote that right in the Washington Post. Here's our secret plot to lure them into the quicksand. Like, right in front of everybody anyway. So what's the secret about that? You might as well make Rambo 3 about it, or Rambo 7. Whichever number they're on now, 5, 6?
Yep, exactly. I mean, that's what it's been. And, I mean, it's funny. You occasionally get, like, a kernel of truth from these outlets. You know, they'll say, on one hand, they'll say, you know, Bana al-Abed, the 7-year-old girl being exploited by her, like, jihadi, you know, handlers, is, you know, is the Anne Frank of Syria. That's what they called her. The Washington Post called her the Anne Frank of Syria. God. And then all of a sudden, and then, like, oh, you know, and then they, you know, published some op-ed saying, like, oh, maybe we need to support ISIS And it's like, wait a minute, there's kind of a little conflict in these two narratives. What's happening here?
Right. And you know what? This is my fault too, because I kind of been leading this conversation all over the place. But this is the huge part of the story that we skipped, was how in 2013, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, the Iraqi-dominated faction of Al-Qaeda in Iraq compared to the Syrian-dominated faction, had a falling out. And that really is where ISIS came from. That wasn't really hyperbole, or just barely, when Donald Trump said that Obama created ISIS, because that absolutely was, you know, 3 years into the war, really, before they marched on Mosul. They had already broken off. 2 years into the war, they had broken off eastern Syria. 1 year more than that, they conquered all of western Iraq. And, you know, this is something that comes up from time to time, but not enough, that Trump actually got this right. And it must have been Roger Stone who told him to say this, I think, that because it was earlier on, before Bannon got there, I think. But where he was saying, yeah, Obama created ISIS, and everybody got all outraged and said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you know, by supporting the jihadists in the war in Libya, and then now in Syria as well. And then once they rolled into Iraq, the Americans weren't there to stop them from taking over Western Iraq, which that was true as far as it goes. And in the context that he said it, that much was true. So he didn't have to necessarily be criticizing that fact of the withdrawal from Iraq in the way he did. But still, every word of it was the fact, right? And then he ended up dropping the first part about Obama back to the bad guys. And that's what happened in the scheme of things. We're in 2018. Looking back, all the history gets kind of truncated and all this, right? But these things happened in a sequence. And he dropped all that. And just then, as Mattis instructed him, blackmailed them over Afghanistan, blamed the withdrawal of the forces in 2011. That was what caused the rise of ISIS. And therefore, of course, that's why we have to stay in Afghanistan, stay in everywhere forever, or else. It, even sometimes they say Iran, but even now when they talk about staying in Syria forever, sometimes they bring up the possibility that ISIS could come back conceivably, right? So that's Lesson learned. You can't ever leave. Rather than don't back your enemies like this and create these messes in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, Trump was tweeting about it years ago. You know, it doesn't take a genius to figure it out pretty clearly.
That's true. Right. I mean, he really did say that we were on the side of jihadist bad guys and all that back then.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, he, you know, I doubt he had like a real nuanced understanding of it, but it's certainly more accurate than, you know, what's being pumped out on CNN and kind of melting everyone's brains, you know, on the, at least among coastal elites and, you know, those who actually watch that stuff, which is, you know, decreasing amounts of people all the time actually watch right. it, but
that's true.
Yeah,
thank goodness. And you know, after all, they had to back down on this, partially because of public opinion, partially just as the aftermath of Iraq War II, and people not wanting to do that again. But also, I think, you know, like in 2013, there was a lot of pressure from the right that we don't want to go risk our hides to go help these people, waste our money helping other people, screw them, leave them alone, which is pretty cynical and bad, but pretty good for right-wing anti-war positions. I'll take it, you know, I don't know, I guess. And it's not, could have been much worse, right? Could have been, yeah, let's go kick butt because somebody came up with a pretend gas attack or whatever kind of thing. So they, you know, that is the context that they're working in, is that they really are dragging the American people along on this when the American people, you know, overall really want to come home. So they only were able to do, thank goodness, a half-assed regime change here where it could have really been much worse. But so, you know what? I'm sorry, too, because we've been talking about everything really but the white helmets and with this propaganda arm, really, of Al-Qaeda during this whole war and all the great incriminating evidence you have against them. We talked about the Albania thing, but, you know, these are the great rescuers of little children stuck under concrete and all of these things. And you've really done a great job of making this documentary about this here. Again, the Syria deception. Al-Qaeda goes to Hollywood. And so tell us a little bit more about the deception here and the use of these heroic white helmets, supposedly, to launder this Al-Qaeda jihadi war here.
Well, the white helmets are, you know, they are commonly referred to as a rescue group in that operate exclusively in opposition-held territory in Syria. And, you know, when I say opposition, that's largely Al-Qaeda-dominated. There was a I believe the journalist's name, John Cantley, I believe his name, who was kidnapped by ISIS and forced to do a propaganda video for them, called them the ISIS Fire Brigade. And so essentially it's the, like, ISIS civil defense or Al-Qaeda civil defense. And it's, and they were created by a former British mercenary and funded with money from the UK Home Office, I believe, and the US State Department. And so they, you know, it's, they claim on their website to have rescued like 100,000 people. And it's unclear how many people they may or may have not rescued. I don't really know. But what we do know is there's numerous videos that have come out of them participating in summary executions on the street, you know, that happen in these opposition-controlled areas, you know, whether it's like someone accused of being a spy or collaborating with the government or wanting, you know, reconciliation, or say a woman accused of adultery. And so the White Helmets have been featured in pretty much, I mean, just across the spectrum of Western media outlets as like the heroes of the Syrian war, who, like, you know, we don't, even though there's bad guys and there's all this stuff, these guys are the real heroes. And it's, and they have been really the main vehicle to rehabilitate the image of Al-Qaeda and say, like, you know, these guys are like angels in this horrible place, and they're against Assad, and we just have to support them. But you know, their shady videos of them partaking in summary executions have been totally left out from the mainstream media narrative. And so I actually confronted the director of the film Of Cries from Syria. I went to the screening in, you know, in Capitol Hill, just a few blocks where I am, from where I am, where there was a Republican congressman named Adam Kinzinger and a Democratic congressman named Brendan Boyle. And I went and confronted this director after the film. He's a Russian Israeli who's basically like a, he's kind of like a mercenary filmmaker. He did a film about Ukraine, the Euromaidan in Ukraine, basically, you know, portraying it as this democratic uprising and totally omitting the presence of, you know, neo-Nazis and fascists in that one. And so then he moved on to do Syria. And so I confront him about how he portrayed, you know, a few different people, but I asked him about how he portrayed the White Helmets, and I showed him. He's like, no, you know, that's all fake. All these, you know, all that stuff about them doing executions is fake. And then I showed him the video, which the White Helmets confirmed is real because they released an apology for it. And he just says, well, that's what Sputnik is saying, so it's Russian propaganda. And this was It was 6 months before I even started working at RT, or if I had even thought about like trying to get a job here. I was, you know, just working independently. And so it was like, so the Russians are saying it, which is true. So that doesn't make it true or false. And so he had no, you know, he couldn't say anything. And then I showed him a number of things, and he just basically got angry and told me I'm a Russian propagandist and, you know, stormed off. And it just goes to show how, you know, what a thin veil the propaganda is, that it's like basic minor questioning, very, you know, soft questioning about, like, you know, who these people actually are, why this guy made, you know, these editorial decisions, these creative decisions, and decided to totally omit all the, you know, to put mildly, controversial aspects of all these characters in the film. You know, it's obvious that he is just doing propaganda and getting, I'm sure, paid very handsomely for it. And, you know, so that's what my film kind of tried to poke holes in this narrative. And it's not the only film. It's not just Cries from Syria. I mean, there's, you know, at least a dozen or maybe two dozen films on this whole same subject that are just all kind of have the same narrative, that it's like Assad the evil dictator versus, you know, the people who are rising up, and we just have to support them. And it's just totally false. It's a total disservice to Syrians who are actually suffering. And even, you know, Syrians who do want to see Assad go, who do want to see like a real democratic future, You know, I think what happens basically is there's any spark of any kind of protest, you know, anyone, any dissatisfaction with, you know, the economy or the political establishment. And then you just have, you know, countries like the U.S. and, you know, Western Europe, Saudi Arabia, you know, these countries just come in and pour gas on the spark and just try to burn the entire country down so they can take it over and rebuild it and make a bunch of profit and shape it in their image. And so it's, you know, they claim to be in solidarity with the quote unquote Syrian people. But, you know, they're happy to see Syrian people be cannon fodder for their, you know, wars of so they can, you know, just make a whole bunch of money and destroy anything that challenges, you know, their regional hegemony. And, you know, that's not to mention the cost to, you know, Americans, that our tax dollars are going to fund fanatics who are, you know, going to kill over there and then come back and kill in, you know, Europe and if and the U.S. if they can get there.
Man, it's true. And, you know, another tragedy is Right Said Fred, the guys that I remember from 10th grade. For some reason, I know what grade I was in when that came out, saying I'm too sexy for my shirt. That these guys are part of the PR campaign for the terrorists, but they used to retweet me all the time. They were apparently fans of my show, or one or the other of them was, and including must have been, because it was certainly during this time frame, stuff about Syria, and so must know better. And here they are singing some ridiculous song about the monster Assad, and now we need to have a NATO bombing campaign or something. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just like...
I lost another one, Dan.
Oh, Right Said Fred down the drain. I know. It's sad.
It's killing me.
I know. I hear you. I mean, I was never...
That means I didn't do a good enough job at teaching them what the hell, obviously.
Right Said Fred was a little bit before my time, but, you know, I have Chris Cornell in the movie, and he did... You know, I liked Soundgarden.
I always hated them, so I was...
Oh, really?
I didn't even know the guy died, but...
Oh, yeah. I mean... I wasn't like a huge fan, but you know, when I was a kid, I liked that song "Black Hole Sun." I thought that was pretty cool,
yeah.
and then you know, friends of mine who like really liked him, who were like really into like rock and stuff, but and like grunge. But you know, he kind of lost the plot and did the song with you know using their footage, and then he committed suicide not long after. Which you know, I'm not saying that there's like a you know a core there's not like causation, or I'm not saying it's related, but you know. I guess
he's
maybe.
Like, man, I wish I hadn't put out that video. What kind of State Department sucker am I?
I mean, I'm just saying, maybe, you know, he's, I guess he likes, you know, he did what he had to do for the world at that point. Like, he had served his purpose. He had done his good things.
Oh,
it's like
man.
Michael Jackson, like, made his great music.
We're
and then
getting
he
mean
started
as
like,
hell now. But yeah, no, I'm worse than you. So it's okay.
So.
Yeah. That's horrible. But, you know what? They came to, old Pink Floyd, Roger Waters, and said, hey, want some money to take our side? And he was like, you guys go to hell. What? I can't read? The hell away from me with this. And
right.
So if he can do it, then everybody else can too. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean,
he's a musician. He shouldn't necessarily have to know enough. But apparently it's easy enough for him to know it. So where's everybody else on this?
Yeah, and I mean, Roger Waters took a really bold stand, and you know, he's a guy who doesn't have to do that. He's, you know, obviously in this stage in his career, he's got, you know, more money than probably he knows what to do with, and is, you know, just doing his thing, playing rock concerts, and he could just, you know, like most famous people, just kind of steer clear or just do the easy thing and take the money or whatever. But I mean, he's kind of one of a dying breed of, you know, rock, you know, great musicians who really opposed war. And it says, you know, the phenomenon of Roger Waters kind of says everything to me about Western culture, how the, you know, anti-war culture in Western countries has been kind of totally gutted and rotted out and just doesn't really exist anymore. And so, you know, Roger is just kind of one of the last of that kind, and it's unfortunate, and is really kind of a sign of cultural decay in this country that there's no real anti-war movement. You know, there's no one. It's like we can get like, you know, huge amounts of people to go out and protest about you know, the allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, you know, which are real, and this stuff should be protested. Or you know, people will go you know, protest. What if like if Mueller gets fired, they're ready to go like, you know, storm the gates of the White House, you know, over this like kind of basically a fake scandal of Russiagate.
But I can't wait to see him try that. Yeah, right. But anyway.
But it's like when it comes to like war, you know, when it comes to like agitating for war with Iran or anything like that, you know, it's just total silence. It's like,
well, it's just like in Mitchell and Jessen. It's learned helplessness.
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole point of the torture program, is to get you to say, geez, I keep caring about this, but nothing keeps happening, or it keeps happening, and nothing is stopping it, so, geez, I don't know, maybe move on to the next thing, and, you know, go rescue a puppy or something that you could put your hands on and see the results of, you know? It's easier. It's frustrating to keep losing when you live in a world empire and you can't convince it to stop being one, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing is, in this country, we have this, like, you know, kind of facade of democracy. And so if there's like very clear, you know, demonstration that the public doesn't consent to war, then, you know, there's a chance of stopping it. I mean, you know, when we invaded Iraq, a lot of people came out in, you know, D.C. and New York, but media just had a total blackout on it. So they found a way to kind of just override the whole thing anyway and, you know, create, you know, manufacture the consent for the war.
Right.
But I mean, we don't even see that anymore. It's just like total silence. I mean, we're bombing Syria and it's just like total silence, or like, you know, oh, it's a good thing. Our holy, you know, our beautiful missiles. You know, that's what we hear in our media, and people are like, oh yeah, that's true. They are beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, taking sacrament in the civil religion, firing a tomahawk missile at somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
It was named after a group of people that were completely genocided off the face of the earth, you know, one of their weapons. Anyway, somehow somebody got to them, not sure. Might have been the Union Army.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I went, a couple of years ago, I was talking to a friend in Gaza. I was in Arizona, where I'm from, and I was talking to a friend in Gaza, and he's like, yeah, there's an Apache helicopter right over my building right now. And it's like, you know, Israeli military Apache helicopter.
Yeah.
And I was like, do you know what Apache is? And he's like, no. And I was like, well, that's the Native Americans.
They don't exist anymore. See?
Yeah. That's the Native Americans that we genocided here in Arizona, you know, where I was. That's that you know, used to kind of run the show here that we took out and then
named. Well, your forebears anyway.
Yeah, but you know, the U.S. I should say, but yeah. I mean, it was before my family.
No
was
question,
here,
though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right.
But
all right, man. Well, you know what? We're at almost an hour here, and I want to make sure people can fit this in before dinner or what have you. So let's wrap this up. I want to recommend again the Syria Deception: Al Qaeda Goes to Hollywood, and this is as good as you can get when it comes to debunking the white helmets. For any of you who have liberal or conservative friends who bought into this thing, check out all about Albana and all the rest of this too. It's at grayzoneproject.com, the Syria Deception. And again, you gotta check out, this is free, by the way, it's embedded right there on YouTube, no problem. But there's Killing Gaza, which costs you a couple of bucks to watch on Vimeo. But it's so important that I really hope you guys will look at that too. It's by Dan and Max Blumenthal as well. And thanks again, Dan, for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott. Always appreciated.
Oh, yeah. Take care. Bye. All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah. And read my book, Fool's Errand: Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.